today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, I got you a gift.
Well, thanks, Jim. What prompted you to do that?
You know, my mama told me you better shop around. All right, Patrick, so,
Jim,
recently you went on a trip to Nashville.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was fun. And while you were there, you did an interview with Tyler Mahan Coe.
Cocaine and Rhinestones.
Cocaine and Rhinestones.
I heard his podcast is kind of successful.
It's doing pretty well. We're hoping to ride on those coattails. So yeah. Go back and listen
absolutely
to the interview that you did with Tyler. It was a few episodes ago, a month ago, something like that.
Yeah.
Listen to that. So I was like, well, I can't be outdone.
No.
I got to go on a trip and do an interview, right?
And what we do is we pack up our little microphone and our small recorder. It's really not that big. And we put it in a backpack, really, and just go, right?
That's so what we call it Rockin' the Suburbs on the Road.
Yeah.
I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I recently went to Detroit.
Yeah.
So I had occasion to go. I was visiting my family. They live in Toledo, Ohio, which is right on the Michigan border. Northwest Ohio, and then you drive about an hour north and you're in Detroit. So I took a little day trip up there, and while I was there, I had never been to this attraction before. I went to the Motown Museum.
Can I ask one question before we get into that?
Yes.
Why not the Lions?
Oh, why am I not a Lions fan?
Why the Cleveland Browns?
Okay.
Just briefly, because this has some relevance to Motown and Detroit, because I think you're kind of slagging them.
Yeah. Well, and the Lions, some of the Lions singers, Lions singers, Lions players sang on What's Going On. Did you know What's Going On?
I remember that. Yeah.
So, yeah. So that ties into Motown. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because where I grew up, and I think this is true for a lot of people, when you grow up in a city that does not have major pro sports, you know, you kind of get to pick a little bit.
Yeah.
And for me and my friends, it was pretty much like if you wanted to remain somewhat regional, you could pick Detroit teams, you could pick Cleveland teams, you could even pick Cincinnati teams as your favorite.
The other direction.
Right. And for me, when I was a kid, the Tigers were good.
Yeah.
That was like right when they got like Sparky Anderson came in and they ended up winning the World Series and just had a great team. So I locked into the Tigers from that. And then right around that same time in the 80s, the Browns, believe it or not, were kind of good.
They
first had Brian Sipe, and then they had Bernie Kosar, and they were going to at least conference championship games, although in like spectacular fashion, they would blow those.
We don't want to talk about that.
But anyway, so that was sort of, you know, I picked Tigers, Browns, and then also Pistons. So then it just locked in. That's just been the way it's been.
Those are pretty good teams in that era, though. So well done.
Well, I don't know about that.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
The Tigers have been to two World Series since they won that one. And
they also had Mark Fidrich. So
they did. Oh, that was fun.
You can't go wrong with that.
In fact, oh my God.
He talked to the baseball.
When I was a kid, I know somebody out there is going to remember this. I know somebody of our
besides Jim
of our vintage is going to remember this. There was a magazine that you used to get through school. Remember like Scholastic Book Club and that stuff, right?
I remember those magazines.
And you could get these like bizarre like kids magazines that you could like subscribe to through school, and they'd be, I think they even were like delivered to school or something.
Yeah, and they'd pass you out in the classroom.
There was one called Dynamite. I don't know if you remember this magazine. It was called Dynamite, and it was all like sort of like pop culture-y kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, Mark Fidrich was on the cover of once of Dynamite magazine. I remember this very specifically.
Wait, was the cover written in like neon? And then it had like, I remember that magazine, Dynamite magazine.
Yes. I think there was always like a poster in there or something.
Right. Yeah. I think I got the one with the guy who did Heaven on the Seventh Floor.
I think there was usually something about Christy McNichol.
That's right. She had a giant belt buckle.
I don't know. Great. Okay, we're getting way off course.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So, anyway, so I was just in Detroit and got to visit something
really cool.
I had never visited before, which is the Motown Museum.
Yeah. You're going to love this, folks. It's really, really good.
And the Motown Museum, I'll set this up, but before I do, Well, yes. So I one of the things I picked up, I'm holding it up here for people to see.
It's a great box set.
Is the box set called Hitsville USA, the Motown Singles Collection, 1959 to 1971. Mm-hmm. This actually came out in 92.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of a big deal then. I never had this box set. Four CDs, tons of singles, great music.
I own a copy myself. It's beautiful.
And I picked up something for you, Patrick.
Oh, this is a huge surprise.
Yes, this is.
It's a Gideon's Bible.
There you go. It's a little journal.
Oh, look at this.
You like to write.
Wow, this is fantastic, Jim.
Crazy
I have
things.
Thoughts all the time. Yeah. And the front is like a little vinyl record.
Yeah.
It's already scratched. This is fantastic. It's Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Thank you so much, Jim. This is beautiful, man. I will write you a thank you note with this stationery and tear it out.
One of the classics, right?
This is beautiful. Thank you, my brother.
All right. So there you go. So,
yeah.
Okay. So let me just set this up. So in a little while, you're going to hear an interview that I did, mm-hmm. getting back to packing up the equipment and all of that. Interview I did with Paul Barker. Paul is the director of development for the Motown Museum. So he kind of like runs operations there and stuff like that. But first, let me just sort of describe the museum for people who have not been. And remember when we had Jody Gershon, she was talking about Paisley Park, mm-hmm. and going to that?
Yep. Right after she went on the tour, she called us up.
Right. It's similar in a way, in the sense that it's not, the Motown Museum is not a museum like, say, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum or the Country Music Hall of Fame Museum or what else. I don't know what else would be a good example of like a big, you know, a big exhibition space with like a lot of artifacts where you sort of like walk around on your own, like any kind of like art museum, any kind of, you
know, they have a cafe off museum. To the side and a giant gift shop, right? It's not like
it's not like that. And, but to me, this is even better because what it is for people who don't know the Motown story, West Grand Boulevard is an area, is a main road in Detroit that at one point was all residential. And right at the time when Berry Gordy was founding Motown Records, it was starting to turn commercial. Mm-hmm. And basically they were taking like houses and converting them into businesses on this main street.
Right. We're talking like 1958, something like that.
Yeah.
59.
He found it in 59. Mm-hmm. So he bought one of the houses where he could set up Motown Records on the first floor and he could live upstairs.
Right.
And it literally was like a little two-story house. Right. And then he ended up building a studio. And that was like a converted garage. I think it was like a garage that faced back to like an alley. So like sort of the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he made Studio A, which is where the vast majority of all the great Motown records were recorded right there in just this little house. And so the Motown Museum, and out front there's a big sign that says Hitsville, USA, right? The Motown Museum really is that. You're basically touring. It is the artifact.
That's
amazing. You're touring the house where, you know, Berry Gordy lived and worked, mm-hmm. and all the great artists, you know, from Smokey Robinson on to Marvin Gaye and everybody in between, you know, came through, mm-hmm. and recorded and hung out and bounced ideas off of each other. And
that's amazing.
And all of that, right? And so they've converted part of it into what you might think of as sort of a museum exhibition. And there's, you know, a few sort of artifacts on display and you sort of learn the story. It's like only guided tours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nice because they sort of take you through the whole thing. And they tell you the story of how Berry Gordy started the business. It's really amazing. It's a true, not only just great sort of American success story, because his family was already very entrepreneurial and were successful in a number of businesses, including like construction.
Right. And you'll hear some of that in the interview where they talk about how each sort of offspring got their chance to like basically got a VC behind them.
That's
right.
What's so funny?
Which was their parents.
So his parents, like they started many different businesses.
Amazing.
Like construction was one. And there were, at one point they ran a grocery and all this stuff. And so what they did with all their kids, eight kids, I want to say, mm-hmm. is they basically started up this little like savings and loan kind of thing where everybody had to contribute to it. And then when somebody had an idea, a business idea, they'd come and basically go before the board, which was the family, and make their pitch. And then maybe they could get a business loan.
Yeah.
It's really
from
fascinating.
From their own family. It's amazing. Yeah. It's very inspiring.
Yeah. And so Berry Gordy got $800 to start Motown Records after he had just failed in a record, opening a jazz record store, mm-hmm. you know? So, anyway, so all of that, he used the loan, he invested in it, and it all has been preserved. And the story is that his sister, who basically was kind of like the caretaker of the place after Motown, long after Motown had left Detroit and gone on to LA, and then but they still maintained these buildings. She discovered that people were just coming there. This was like in the mid 80s or something like that. People were just coming there and wanting to see it, saying, you know, knocking on the door.
Yeah.
Can I see the studio? Can I see the house?
Yeah.
Can I, you know? And so then when, you know, they sort of figured out, well, we should really make this into an attraction, mm-hmm. and not just this informal thing where people can stop by.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So anyway, it's all preserved. It's wonderful. I love the experience so much that, you know, when the way they set up the tour is that they save the studio for the end. And when you get there, you're almost, it was just this like wave of emotion that just sort of ran over me. It's like, yeah, I heard this whole story about
very interesting.
all these recording artists, all these great performers, all these people, these songs that you've heard all these years. And then you get to this spot and it's an old converted garage.
Amazing.
It's not like, you know, Capitol Records where, yeah, you know, Frank Sinatra recorded or something, yeah, like that.
Mm-hmm.
It, and you almost can't believe that it happened there.
Yeah.
And yet it's unreal.
You know the music so well. Yeah. It's like part of you. Yes. So you can kind of feel that connection between the two things. That's what I took from when you told me, yeah, that originally. I was like, that's really powerful.
And man, they did this one thing I think that was just perfect, which is that when you get to the studio in there, they have these, a handful of these big sort of framed photos of people recording in the studio that you're standing in. Mm. And they have them up on the wall, sort of positioned so that almost like you can figure out from the photos where they were standing in the studio, and you can like stand in that spot. I mean, yeah, you can't walk through the whole thing. You walk through certain parts, but they show you, like, there was one of the Temptations, and I think it was David Ruffin, and he's like singing into a microphone that's hanging from the ceiling, and you can figure out exactly where that was and which microphone. The cable is still hanging down from the ceiling, and you're like, you know, you could just stand right there, and it's just, yeah, it sort of gives you chills a little bit,
yeah,
when you
think
about
that. Yeah, that's really
cool. So
that's amazingly cool.
It was really cool. So let's, I have a couple other stories, but I'll save those for later.
Yeah.
Let's get to the first part of the interview here with Paul, where he talks about sort of, you know, Berry Gordy, but also he's a lifelong Detroiter, and he talks about, you know, kind of what Motown means to that city.
Yeah. Born, kind of raised in his early years there, right?
Yep. So, Paul, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast. And we are sitting here. You were telling me as we were walking in, one of the, this is the house right next to the Motown Museum, the Hitsville USA house, right?
Yes.
But it's not actually part of the original sort of Motown empire on West Grand Avenue, right?
Yes. Motown started in Hitsville USA, as you know, and as they expanded, they bought homes on West Grand Boulevard to occupy their growing company and offices and departments. But not everyone was selling at that time. Berry Gordy was purchasing homes because West Grand Boulevard is, as you noticed, a collection of large homes.
Right.
And it became commercialized, a commercial district, so people could open a business in one of these homes. So when Berry Gordy first bought it, he lived upstairs and worked downstairs in Hitsville, but started buying homes to expand his business in. And in this particular house that's adjacent from Hitsville, it was a doctor's office, and the doctor had a good business, so he didn't sell immediately, and Motown just kind of grew around him, and so went down the block and across the street, and many years later he did sell out and it became part of the Motown family, but originally it was not.
Okay.
But Motown was a total of seven houses on one side of the block and one across the street.
Did you grow up in Detroit? Are you always from Detroit?
I did. I was born and raised in Detroit. Okay. I lived here until I was 25 years old, and then traveled a bit and then moved out into the suburbs.
What does it mean to the city, you think, to still have the original Hitsville USA house, you know, preserved as a museum and tourist attraction?
I think it's what is it? That's a good question. What does it mean to the city to have this jewel like Hitsville USA and Motown Museum? I think it's important because we kind of tell the story like Detroit is like the grandmother. Like she raises you, she teaches you right, but then she sets you out in the world to go and find your own. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things are born and raised in Detroit business-wise, and right. then they go out and they find a home somewhere else, but they never forget where grandma lives, you know? So for a lot of people, they know that Motown grew and it expanded and eventually went to California, but they know its home is here.
Yeah.
And so to have that tangible piece of their history here is incredible, and it's never been forgotten, and people understand that, like they know that the Detroit years were the years for Motown. It spawned all the great talent that would carry the flagship company for years and years and years. So to have it preserved and to have it never be anything else, like it stayed a Detroit office, the studio never became like a storage room or something, you know, right, it's right. always been what it is. You have this unique opportunity where you can literally walk back in time and see where and how it was done.
That studio, Studio A, is just amazing. I was just there, and our tour guide talked about, you know, famous musicians come to visit, that it's become this mecca of sorts in popular music. And it is so true. When you see it, the most amazing thing to me, and literally my eyes were welling up just, you know, thinking about the people who worked there, recorded there, the great music. When you see sort of how modest it is, that's one of the things that's most amazing about it, because the Motown records had this big sound. I mean, amazing, clean, clear, you know, big sound that you would think would be produced in some, you know, out, you know, where Phil Spector did his work or Brian Wilson or something like that. And here it is just in this house, right? It's almost unreal in some ways. And you get that kind of reaction from people who come here?
Pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
Even some of the younger ones that still don't even know who some of the people are. They know the impact. Like, they know they're there for a reason. And they're trying to discover what that reason is. And some people lived it, some people did not. And so when they come through and they hear about the tour and what came from here, and they, you know, learn more about the company and the successes, and then they get into this little room, which is pretty much the birthplace of everything that they just heard about, and they see it's just a little old photography studio that was turned into a recording right. studio, they're kind of like, oh, you know, it's just kind of an aha moment, because then they're like, if they can do it here, you know, I could do anything too. You know, they just used what they had. And, you know, Motown was this incredible place that just gave people a place to try.
Yeah.
Just try something. And when you know you have a place to try, you're not afraid of failure, you know, so you kind of go for it. And that's what this little house was. It was a place where people could come and just try. And I think people kind of get that once they finally get down there, because, their brain wants them to see this big fancy studio. So they almost have an out, like, well, if I had something like this, I would have done it too, you know? But when they see it's this little tiny room, they're like, oh my gosh, well, I've got some work to do.
I mean, you know, people talk about the late 70s and like punk rock and that do it yourself DIY spirit and all of that, but you know, it existed long before then. And this is proof of that right here. So.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Motown was definitely a do-it-yourself place. And again, it was a place that offered opportunity. You know, the studio was open 24 hours a day. You will hear Smokey Robinson tell that story. You could have an idea at 4 o'clock in the morning and come over and work it out. And it was that kind of environment that just spawned creativity and spawned artistry and spawned independence, because again, people had a place to just try. And, you know, those kind of places just don't exist. You know, there's Smokey Robinson also tells a story that there's talent everywhere, but it took a place like Hitsville and it took a person like Berry Gordy to give people the chance to utilize that talent, utilize those skills. So, yeah, that do-it-yourself mentality was born here and continues to spawn entrepreneurs and artists to this day with that philosophy of just doing it yourself.
You know, I started this by asking about what this means to Detroit. People think of Motown as a Detroit story. People think of it as, you know, the sounds of young America, right? And a sort of youth culture revolution that happened. But with Berry Gordy, what you have is a true American success story. I mean, that's at the heart of what this is all about, right?
It is about that, being an American success story. But I want to reach back a minute. Like Detroiters don't consider this a Detroit success story. Detroiters consider this their success story. Okay. Like so many people knew the artist and knew the people who worked here and knew the couple of hundred employees. Like they take personal ownership of an association with this success. Outsiders see it as a Detroit success story, or international folks see it as like an American success story. But it truly is, if you needed to put a label on it, it is one of the most quintessential American success stories. Somebody who had a dream, went for it, and not only achieved it, but kept reaching down and pulled others up to experience the same. And that is very much the Motown and dream and the American dream.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, Berry Gordy's story about what he learned from his prior experiences, you know, working on a, you know, auto assembly line, being in the military, being a professional boxer. You know, he brought all these experiences to his new venture, which was the music business, right? I mean, there's a lesson there for people to sort of always, you know, take something from that experience in life and then apply it to whatever you do next. So.
Absolutely. And it even transcends more than just the assembly line. Like when Berry Gordy grew up, he worked in his parents' business. You know, he worked for his father on either construction sites and contracting mm-hmm. work or in the family grocery store. Everything was an opportunity. And, you know, even Berry Gordy needed a place to try. So, you know, when his parents had this corner grocery store, they had a couple of storefronts on either side where they let the kids work out an idea and they could take one of the storefronts. And if it worked, they could stay in business. If it didn't work, 6 months later, they'd let another one of their siblings try a business. Well, Berry Gordy early on tried opening the 3D Jazz Record Mart,
right.
You know, and he wanted to sell jazz records because he loved Billie Holiday and other jazz artists. Well, people weren't buying jazz. They were buying rock and roll. And of course, he eventually went out of business because people just weren't buying those records anymore. They were buying the new sound. And he said the lesson that he learned was that don't sell people what you want, sell people what they want. So everything was a learning opportunity for him. But again, he was given a place to try. And so he valued opportunity. He valued that concept and valued experience in implementing it when and where he could. And that was part of the success.
But the other amazing thing too about it was somehow he figured out it wasn't just about give people what they want, but almost sort of anticipating what they would want, because Motown music, you know, advanced the form. It moved it ahead. It sort of seemed to understand culturally where we were going and what people would latch onto. And I don't know if you have any insight into that, but it's sort of an amazing, you know, gift that he had, right?
I think that concept of the Motown sound is a little easier to adapt to in hindsight. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the early catalog and the early music, you'll see that Berry Gordy in the early days was making what amounted to doo-wop records with groups like the Satin Tones and others.
The Motor City, now that's the place I'm singing of. Hey, hey, the Motor City, now that's the place I'm singing of. Well, I've traveled around from town to town. That is where I met my love.
Trying to find his place in the music field that existed because they were looking right. for certain sounds. But once they established themselves a little bit, Berry Gordy again let people just try. And so they came up with their own sounds and they came up with their own styles. And you had a house band like the Funk Brothers who had their own style. Not all of them could even read music. They played purely on rhythm and feel. And that is what is communicated in a record, a non-formula.
Right.
And I think it's easier for people to just say there's this philosophy of how that success was made, but there wasn't. It was very organic and very real. And I think that's what spoke to people. They could find a little bit of themselves in the music because it was so different. But they had to go through their own growth process too.
Like the
One other just funny little story about the studio there. This was, I think, my favorite thing on the whole tour.
Yeah.
Right before you go into the studio, they have preserved like a, you know, 60s era candy machine.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So imagine like just kind of a small, not these big like vending machines that like over your head, but just like a small little machine that would might be like chest high, maybe. Almost picture like a cigarette machine kind of thing, right?
Okay.
But it's a candy machine.
Right.
It has like levers that you pull.
Got it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just like one row of candy that goes across. Okay. And it's just sitting there. It was a dime for a candy bar.
Uh-huh.
And they say, they told the vendor who would come in and fill it up. They said, you can put any candy anywhere you want, except the slot that has the Baby Ruth has to always have the Baby Ruth. Hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is because Baby Ruth was Stevie Wonder's favorite candy bar.
Really?
And that way he would always know which lever to pull, right?
I see. That's amazing.
So people would give him a dime. He'd go over and put it in, and he'd count like 1, 2, 3, 4 over.
Pull
boom,
it. Yeah.
Baby Ruth. And he was a kid then at the time, right?
That's amazing.
You know? So I just...
What a cool story.
What a great story is that, right?
That's amazing.
Okay. So tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit more about Motown. We're going to have more of the interview with Paul Barker. And more tomorrow sort of on... the culture, I think, of Motown and what it meant to the times, which is really important.
It's very important.
It's kind of the soundtrack of the 60s in, to a large extent.
So. Yeah. And to the city of Detroit.
That's
obviously,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So please listen.
Every day.
Every day, like tomorrow. And please rate and review Rock in the Suburbs on Apple Podcasts. And I'd love to hear if people have their own thoughts about Motown. I think that'd be great.
Yeah. In exchange for an interesting historical interview like this, that's the least you can do.
That's people. Right. The number you can call is 612-440-1984. You can leave a message there, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram @suburbspod. All right, we'll get back to the interview tomorrow. Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Is there a Motown song maybe we should play?
Wow, here? Jim, that's a big ask. I mean, you're asking to play like a Motown song, huh? Mr. Postman. That's my favorite Motown song that I can think of
right now.
That's
a great one. The Marvelettes, and it was Motown Records' first number one.
All right.
Perfect. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Great. I love it.